This is the Book Club at 91.7. Thanks for tuning in on this Saturday morning. I'm Mark Purcell. He is the author of Wicked, that multi-million copy bestseller that turned into a Broadway play and became a cultural phenomenon. Now he is looking at Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. 2015 was the 150th anniversary of Alice in Wonderland, and Gregory Maguire uses that as the jumping-off point for his new novel, After Alice. Gregory Maguire, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Gee, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be with you this morning.
So you delved into the Brothers Grimm and Baum, and now on to Lewis Carroll. Was it just the anniversary that prompted you to turn to Alice in Wonderland, or what was your motivation here, Greg?
Well, I'll tell you, I was always a little bit skittish about approaching Alice, although after the surprising success of Wicked, my agent immediately turned to me and said, "Why don't you try Wonderland next?" That was 20 years ago, because Wicked is now 20 years old. And at the time I said to him, "Bill, I'm not insane. I mean, L. Frank Baum is a good writer, but Lewis Carroll is a genius. He's on the same shelf with Milton and Keats and Shakespeare and Emily Dickinson and Melville. So no. I'm not that brave. I don't want to be hoisted by my own petard and have my private parts handed to me in a teacup. No, thank you." What happened, though, is 20 years on, I have discovered two things. One is that I am a little bit braver than I thought. And the second thing is I'm also more humble than I thought, because I have come around to realizing that for great works of art, there is no amount of play that can ever detract from their significance or their power. Now, I'll give you an example. A little less than 100 years ago, I think, if my dates are correct, Marcel Duchamp painted a mustache on the Mona Lisa, thus beginning Dadaism, just enshrining Dadaism and absurdism as the dominant aesthetic motif of the first part of the 20th century. Did that in any way cut away from Da Vinci's achievement? Does the Mona Lisa fail in any way to stir us if we happen, luckily, to be able to catch sight of her in the corner of a room in the Louvre? No, it doesn't. So once I realized I could not undercut the ground from Lewis Carroll, I actually relaxed a little bit and thought, gee, it'd be fun to take a vacation. I haven't been out of the country in a long time. Let's go to Wonderland, get my passport, get my money, get my tickets, get my typewriter. I'm going down.
Well, I have to ask, you know, not Duchamp, but there have been plenty of people who I would say could be considered having put a mustache on Alice in Wonderland. It's been, you know, touched on so often. You know, did you ever fear that even though you were brave, that there was still room for failure there?
Oh, yes. Mercifully, in the life of an artist, there's always room for failure. That's what keeps us timid, and that's what keeps us going, because if we were sure we could do what we wanted to do, we wouldn't bother. You know, it's the runner's high, if you will, of writing, to see how close you can go to the goal that you have set for yourself. And it better be a pretty hard goal, or it's not worth the effort. You might as well, you know, put back the Barca lounger and pour the beer, because what's the point if you're not actually pushing against something? But don't you agree that Alice in Wonderland lives in our kind of cultural subconscious and consciousness as a kind of perennial mystery that can never really be unriddled? So in that way, it kind of doesn't matter how many people, put on their pith helmet and grab their axe and their ropes and descend down the rabbit hole to find out what's down there. It's always new for every different person. It's a picture of our subconscious.
And it seems like a timeless picture, too. I was struck more than once while reading After Alice how some of those societal pressures that they were feeling back in the mid-19th century in Oxford, England, are the same today.
They really are. They change their skirts, of course. Fashions change and language changes. But the basic fears, timidities, hopes, and insecurities that have bedeviled the race for the last 30,000 years are as true in the 21st century as they are in the 19th century. And while, of course, I hope that every listener following this conversation is going to rush either to the bookstore or to the library and grab a copy of my After Alice, while you're doing it, Also pick up a copy of Alice in Wonderland, and here's a challenge to you. If you flip through the pages of this book, Alice in Wonderland, 150 years ago, written 150 years ago, you will find that Alice speaks still with an absolutely modern syntax. I mean, it's true, she's not on her cell phone all the time. She's not on FaceTime. She's not following dance moms. But other than the superficial accoutrements of how children play, the language of Alice could be said by any 8 or 10 or 11-year-old walking home from school, talking to a nosy neighbor on the street or a bossy teacher who runs into her at the corner store. She is timeless.
Gregory Maguire, the author of Wicked and many other wonderful novels. You can learn more about his work at wvxu.org. And you mentioned, I did not go out and get a copy of Lewis Carroll's book, but I was wondering, Ada Boyce is the little girl who gets lost in your book After Alice, who falls down the rabbit hole just after Alice, looking for her friend. And it's mentioned that Ada shows up in Carroll's original book. Tell us a little bit about Ada.
She really shows up in only one sentence. As Alice, in Lewis Carroll's 1865 masterpiece, has fallen down the rabbit hole and is wondering why everything seems so strange, she asks herself the question, I hardly feel like myself. I wonder if I could have turned into someone else. But if I'm not myself, who might I be? Well, I'm not Ada, because Ada's hair goes in ringlets, and mine is perfectly straight. And I'm certainly not Mabel, because she's so dreadfully stupid, and I'm quite brilliant, actually. Now, when you read that, you think, well, that sounds very much like a child. But in fact, these are the only two names that Alice mentions on her dream journey through Wonderland that she has carried with her down below the ground. She doesn't dream or mention of her big sister, who's supposed to be babysitting her, or her mother, or her father. The only two people she names from the above ground world are Ada and Mabel. Well, Mabel is too stupid to have a whole book written about her. I decided that early on. But Ada's hair is in ringlets. That's all Lewis Carroll told us about her, that she exists, she's Alice's friend, and her hair goes in ringlets. So immediately my writer's mind, like a detective, like a sleuth, says, now, why would her hair be in ringlets? Maybe because she's intolerably ugly otherwise, and so her poor nurse has tried to torture some beauty onto her unappealing form. And as soon as I think that, Ada's character begins to come together in my mind, like the way a dust ball gathers dust under the bed, or the way an egg that's poaching begins to gather white and consistency as it's in hot water. As soon as I have one idea about Ada Boyce, then the other ideas begin to come. And suddenly I feel Lewis Carroll has left me a little lifeline and has said, sure, Mr. Maguire, if you're interested, here's a little clue about what I didn't say about Wonderland. Feel free to follow it if you like. So I actually feel vaguely welcomed to do this this sort of trip of spelunking, I think it's called,
yes,
when you go down into the caves with a pickaxe and a light to see what's there.
Well, and the story starts with Ada seeing the White Rabbit. Along the way, runs into the Mad Hatter and Cheshire Cat and, of course, the Queen of Hearts. As you were building your adventure in Wonderland with Ada, how much did you lean back to Lewis Carroll's Alice?
Well, in this one particular way, I leaned very hard, which is that I wanted the characters that Ada meets in Wonderland to be consistent with who they are in Alice. I did not want there to be any great revelation, such as you might see in wonderfully juicy magazines, you know, by the checkout counter in the supermarket. I didn't want to write the seamy side of Wonderland. I didn't want to write what really goes on, a scathing expose of all the, you know, filthy sex and the bad behavior of improper people down in Wonderland. No, I wanted the characters to maintain the integrity that Lewis Carroll had given them, which is a kind of integrity of insanity, you might agree. And as soon as I decided that, then the characters seemed to step out of my own subconscious and speak their lines in character, as it were. That is, the White Rabbit is still the White Rabbit. The Mad Hatter and the March Hare are still having their tea party, and they're still speaking with a kind of interior logic that defies exterior explanation. I felt almost as if I was channeling the voice of Lewis Carroll. I didn't want it to be a parody, and I didn't want it to be a sock puppet where I was moving my fingers and speaking out of the corner of my mouth. But the voices of Lewis Carroll just seemed to come up in me unbidden and speak their lines. That's one of the ways that I deduce that what Lewis Carroll gave us is really an eternal gift. It will keep speaking for another 150 years, I think. And if After Alice amuses people for 10 or 15 years or even more, boy, I'll be happy about that too.
Gregory Maguire, his new novel's After Alice. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. And there's the story of Ada chasing Alice through Wonderland, but there's also the above ground story that's happening here. And you look at the times there in Oxford, England, and mentioned the Victorians and their rules, and a lot of it encompassed in Lydia, the older sister who is supposed to be babysitting Alice when she disappeared, and Lydia plays a central role in your book After Alice as well. But you mentioned research earlier, so did you spend a lot of time looking back at what Oxford, England was like back in 1865?
I certainly did. I went to Oxford a number of times. I had been there before, but I went specifically with this book in mind to try to walk in streets and meadows that must maintain some degree of atmosphere, even if not exactitude, about how they were laid out and used in the times 150 years ago. But I did a great deal of research, too. I read 5 or 6 books about Darwin, because there's nothing that shakes up the mid-19th century in the West like the publications of Darwin and the realization, the gulping realization by especially the pious in England and America and in Europe, that what Darwin is proposing might be the truth about science and evolution, could in fact upend what people previously had recognized as literal truth, the stories of the Old Testament. So this was a time of great certitude and great rectitude, but also great uncertainty. The one thing I have that Lewis Carroll doesn't have is a sense of what happened after the 19th century and how far-reaching Darwin's dynamite actually exploded and what it really did to world knowledge and to world culture and to societies. It did many amazing things, some of them good and some of them with sad consequences, but it certainly shook things up. It's the one thing Lewis Carroll could not have predicted, because he lived within the 19th century and he died before it was over.
I have to say, and I told you before we went on the air, I just loved your linguistic acrobatics that happened throughout After Alice. And I'm wondering what it takes to craft some of these sentences, both in the style of Carroll, but in your own unique voice, Gregory, because some of these, I just love how you put some of these words together.
I suppose in the same way that if you after your recording day is over, stopped at a pub or bar and you ordered a beer, and then you ordered a second beer, maybe you ordered a fourth beer, and the Beatles came on and you began to sing along with the Beatles because you were in that state of cheer, you might find that you were singing in a Liverpudlian accent. You know, you wouldn't actually be thinking about it, but it would be coming out because that's what you've heard. That's how you learned those songs. I think that there's an analogy here for the way that I crafted the prose style, both for the above ground Oxford 1863 part of the story, and also for the Lewis Carroll Wonderland part where Ada is down below meeting those insane characters. I think that I fell into a 19th century rhythm and role and a 19th century use of language almost, not quite by accident, but by dint of having had such great exposure to 19th century writing as a child, reading Lewis Carroll and reading a few other later 19th century writers and turn of the century writers like J.M. Barrie and Kenneth Graham, people like that, but also as an adult, having studied a great deal of 19th century for my literary studies in college. So it just kind of comes up when you need it. I can sing like the Beatles pretty well, but I haven't had enough beer this morning, so I'm not going to treat you to my Liverpudlian accent.
Well, thank you again for a lovely tale, Gregory, and thanks for spending some time sharing stories this morning.
All you need is love. All you need is love. On that note, I will sing my way downstairs to another cup of coffee. Thanks so much, and I hope your readers enjoy taking a return trip to Wonderland.
Gregory Maguire, the novel's After Alice. You can learn more at WVXU.org. The Book Club at 91.7.